You are listening to a sermon by Randy Schmidt, recorded on January 20th, 2008, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thanks very much, Andre. With regard to the confusion of the worship leader this morning, what came to mind was, you know how sometimes there's a word in a language, in a culture, that just has real resonance in that particular language? Well, in Haiti, there's a word, and it's in Haitian Creole, it's dégagé, and that means improvise. And that is one of the most frequently used words in Haiti when you live there, because nothing ever goes according to plan in Haiti. And so this morning, not dégagé nous, we're improvising. And I think there's a lesson in that. One of the things I learned in living in Haiti is I think we get too hung up on things going according to plan all the time. And often it's when things don't go according to plan that we really see God working and become more open to hearing God amongst us. So I'm very happy to be here this morning, and I want to thank you again for having me back and for your interest in Haiti and the Dominican Republic and the work of international child care. And thank you again for your very generous response to the last time we were here. We were recipients of some very generous gifts for the work that is going on in Haiti. And International Child Care is a Christian health development agency that works in Haiti and the Dominican Republic. It has a children's hospital for a pediatric tuberculosis facility for children in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And it has community health programs that it runs in the slums around the hospital, Grace Children's Hospital in Port-au-Prince, as well as in different parts, remote, isolated parts of the country. And it has in the Dominican Republic a kind of a special program outreach for children with disabilities in Santiago, Dominican Republic. I'm not sure if some of you have had the chance to maybe visit Haiti or the Dominican Republic. The DR is kind of a place that a lot of Canadian tourists go to. ICC just celebrated its 40th anniversary this last month, so it's been around for a little while. I know you have strong advocates in this congregation for international child care, Ed and Frida Epp, and they have worked for many years for ICC and contributed for many years steadfastly to the organization and to the work. And I first knew of them when I lived and worked in Haiti from 1991 to 1994, and actually I've just gotten to know them a little bit better this last couple of years when we both ended up in Vancouver and found each other here. But it's inspiring for me to see their ongoing compassion and passion for the work and their ongoing efforts to support the work of people in Haiti. And this is kind of a theme that I want to explore with you today. The idea of persisting and standing with people who live in places of despair, where there have been many efforts, but maybe on a broad country scale, little apparent progress. Places that are viewed as lost causes sometimes. This is what I'd like to explore with you this morning. How do we respond to those kinds of places? And I do so with some qualifiers. I am not a theologian with any special biblical or spiritual insight, and I'm not really a true authority on Haiti or the Dominican Republic. I'm a person who had the privilege of living in Haiti and traveling to the Dominican Republic for several years. I'm a person who struggles in my own understanding about life and about my beliefs. And a person who feels some responsibility to try and be a voice for my Haitian and Dominican friends. And I know to a large extent I'm preaching to the converted here. I know there's many among you who have given generously and been steadfast in support of places around the world that are in turmoil. Coming from a Mennonite heritage myself, I know that's been an important part of Mennonite heritage. So the question that I often hear about Haiti goes something like this. Things in Haiti seem to be going from bad to worse. How will it ever get better? Why should Canada help? What can I ever do that will make any real difference in a place like that, that's so troubled? And when presented with this kind of question, I think our answer really matters. And I propose that it's our response to the situations that seem hopeless and full of despair, where there are no easy solutions, that really act as a kind of a bellwether for the direction of our society. And I want to further propose that, for me, it's two things that help determine our individual and collective actions in the face of lost causes. And for me, they are, one, our view of the promises of God, and two, our view of the value God places in every person. And not just our view of it, because it's one thing to intellectually acknowledge those things, but it's another thing to kind of, to the extent to which it's part of our consciousness, part of our day-to-day thinking and approach to the situations we encounter, the way those things infuse us. So let me tell you a little bit about when I first went to Haiti. I went to Haiti to work for International Child Care in 1991. And I experienced an intense chapter of its history. Following the departure of the Baby Doc, many of you, I'm sure, have heard of Papa Doc and Baby Doc regimes, dictators that ruled Haiti for quite a while. Baby Doc was forced out in 1986, and what followed was a time of turmoil where there were six or seven coup d'etats and new generals rotating through trying to take control of the country. And in May or June of 1991, finally there was a glimmer of hope in the sense that there were United Nations-sponsored, democratically elections that elected Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power. And I arrived in the country about a month or two after that, and in July. It was about 1 month later that I woke up in the morning to the sound of gunfire in the distance, and the smell of smoke from burning tires on blockades throughout the streets in Port-au-Prince. And I discovered that the military had forced President Aristide out of the country, put him on an airplane, and sent him out of the country. In the period that followed, there was a military group of generals who ruled the country. And their modus operandi was to regularly drive into the slums late at night, shoot a few people, and pull out their bodies and leave them on the streets, the main streets. And you can imagine the chilling effect of driving by these bodies on the way to work in the morning. It was their way of maintaining power and control by terror. So the international community responded by throwing up a naval blockade around the country to block the importation of gas and food and supplies into the country. And it was quite a surreal thing to be there at that time. You could go to the beach and you could see in the distance, in this beautiful Caribbean beach setting, you could, offshore there was this big warship. Far away you could see. You could hear the kind of the helicopter. You could see the helicopter patrolling the waters. And so while the target of the blockade was to try to choke the military who were in control, those of us who were working at ICC and Grace Children's Hospital saw children coming to us more and more malnourished and sick. There was a real sense of being isolated and besieged during this time. At that time, I was on a trip back to Canada, and I was asked to speak at a church. And I came across a passage, Jeremiah 32, which was a part of that passage was read this morning. And it really resonated with me as I left a country that was really feeling surrounded and besieged. Here you have a situation where Israel is on the outs with God. The armies of Babylon have invaded and surrounded Jerusalem. And Jeremiah is being held prisoner. Things don't look very good, needless to say. All the evidence points to imminent conquest, destruction, and death. And God asks Jeremiah, who is in a prison cell, to do something quite strange. He asks him to invest in some real estate. And he asks him to invest in some real estate to buy a land that's already in the hands of the Babylonians. And I'll just read a verse or two to quickly take us through that chapter. Looking at chapter 32, starting at verse 2, and I'm reading in the New International Version. The army of the king of Babylon was then besieging Jerusalem, and Jeremiah the prophet was confined in the courtyard of the guard in the royal palace of Judah. Skipping up to verse 6. Jeremiah said, "The word of the Lord came to me. Hanamel, son of Shallum, your uncle is going to come to you and say, 'Buy my field at Anathoth, because as nearest relative, it is your right and duty to buy it.' Then, just as the Lord has said, my cousin Hanamel came to me in the courtyard of the guard and said, 'Buy my field at Anathoth in the territory of Benjamin, since it is your right to redeem it and possess it. Buy it for yourself.' I knew that this was the word of the Lord, so I bought the field at Anathoth for my cousin Hanamel and weighed out for him 17 shekels of silver. I signed and sealed the deed and had it witnessed and weighed out the silver on the scales." So it's quite an incredible, I mean, putting myself in that situation, it would seem a very odd request and something that wouldn't be first on my mind to try to do. And this is Jeremiah's response a little bit further on, expressing, I think, some of that incredulity, excuse me. See, starting in verse 24, "See how the siege ramps are built up to take the city? Because of the sword, famine, and plague, the city will be handed over to the Babylonians who are attacking it. What you said has happened, as you now see. And though the city will be handed over to the Babylonians, you, O sovereign God, say to me, 'Buy the field with silver in it, and have the transaction witnessed.'" It seems a preposterous request. Yet here is God's response. "Even though things seem hopeless and you are about to go through great hardship, I promise I will restore you one day. And I want you to act on that promise, to do something that is witnessed by others." And I think I wonder if that's important, the witness of it, because it reminds your people of that promise of restoration. And so you have the verses that were read. And I'll just reread the last few verses, starting at verses 42. "This is what the Lord says. As I have brought all this great calamity on this people, so I will give them all the prosperity I have promised them. Once more, fields will be bought in this land of which you say it is a desolate waste, without man or animals, for it has been handed over to the Babylonians. Fields will be bought for silver, and deeds will be signed, sealed, and witnessed in the territory of Benjamin, in the villages around Jerusalem, in the towns of Judah, and in the towns of the hill country, of the western foothills and of the Negev, because I will restore their fortunes, declares the Lord." So this passage presents me with a challenge. What do I believe about God's promises of restoration in today's world? Is there a lesson here about what God wants of me when the evidence points to despair? It also presents me with an inspiration about how actions in the face of darkness, and sometimes in spite of the darkness, can help remind people of our ultimate hope. During my tumultuous months in Haiti, I gained respect for international child care. During the coup, I saw dedicated Haitian staff braving the streets to come to Grace Children's Hospital to take care of the children and keep services going. And I saw Haitian staff working under duress to keep the supply chains going of vaccines out to the remote areas and taking them up into the mountains with donkeys up to remote vaccination clinics. When the military thugs in these regions viewed those gatherings suspiciously and often arrested and beat people up. While the city was unstable in the fall of 1991 with erratic electricity, limited supplies of gas and food, I was given the job of pulling together a proposal for U.S. government funding. The proposal was for a program to bring basic health services to the region south of the capital to an unserved population of about 600,000 people. So it was my opportunity to learn about the challenges of Haiti and the ICC response. In Haiti, about 80 out of every 1,000 children die before the age of 5, compared to 4 in Canada. The top causes are, and this is the sad thing, they're preventable illnesses. The number one cause is as basic as dehydration from diarrhea. And that is caused by poor water, bad sanitation. Others causes are preventable with immunizations. So the ICC response, motivated by our belief in showing God's love in practical ways, was to engage a community health model that would better deliver basic health, that would deliver basic health education, clean water and sanitation projects and vaccinations. And most important was to make a long-term, in terms of making a long-term difference, was the way in which we would approach the work and conduct it. So the, what was important to us was to begin by, when we would go into a community, engage the community leaders themselves, have those leaders organize their own local health committee, and have the health committee choose a local resident to be trained by ICC to deliver health education, vaccinations, and monitor the growth of children. So it was actually quite fascinating to see this happen at that time in Haiti's history. Here you had a time when there was, at a national level, this kind of struggle over democracy, bringing democracy to Haiti and having democratically elected president returns to Haiti. And it was a real struggle. You weren't seeing that at the national level. But at the local level, I would attend in these mountain villages. You would have these groups of village elders getting together and talking about their problems, taking ownership of their problems, and voting. So at the local level, you would have this very strong kind of powerful example of democracy at action, even if at the national level, people were struggling. And because of its respectful and rigorous approach, I think ICC had a high degree of credibility. And I was impressed. Here, when other organizations were shutting down, evacuating, and leaving, ICC was planning and moving forward. We were investing in the fields of Haiti, even as the forces of violence held the ground. And as a result, in this case, 600,000 Haitians received vital health services over the next 3 years in that particular project that I was working on. So, what happens when we take that kind of a step? When we take actions in the face of darkness to invest, to reflect and remind people of hope? Well, in Haiti, I wanted to tell you a little bit more about the impact of such programs. Let me give you a snapshot of one program ICC runs in the slums around Grace Children's Hospital in Port-au-Prince. If you walk through what's called the Cité, or the slums of Port-au-Prince, and you may have heard in the news the most famous slum is Cité Soleil in Port-au-Prince, where there was recently a lot of gang violence. It's the headquarters of a lot of violent gangs. Around Grace Children's Hospital, there's several cités or blocks of small neighborhoods of shacks. And if you walk through them, you see on each ramshackle home a red mark. And this indicates a Haitian ICC health worker has surveyed that household, identified the children, and given each a growth monitoring and vaccination card. You would come across weekly mothers' clubs meetings where women and children would come to sing and pray, and then talk about health topics like sanitation, nutrition, and breastfeeding. You would see at those meetings children receiving vaccinations and being weighed and charted. So it would just be this kind of loud, noisy meeting with children crying as they were getting their shots and singing and discussions and sessions going on. It was just a wonderful place to be. And you would see children whose growth, what they did was if they would weigh the children regularly, so every child in those slum areas would be followed. And as there's a growth chart, and if the weight started to fall off, it was a way of identifying children who were in trouble, and then special services could be provided to that household. And it was quite something to walk through those neighborhoods where a foreigner may not feel safe normally, but because of the work of ICC, and as I was walking with our senior Haitian health supervisor, we were warmly greeted, and he would go from house to house, and they would call him in the cultural way, Papa, going through those neighborhoods, and he knew each of those households and each of the families and could call them by name and ask them specifically about their children and encourage them. So it was quite something. And so in that way, you could see the impact of Canadians and Americans and others supporting Haitian health workers and standing with the forgotten poorest of the poor. Well, I'm not sure if the rest of the world has really noticed. For Haitians themselves, you know, we talk about those actions being witnessed. They were the witnesses of that action and that investment. And for them, it meant a world of a difference when their country was being besieged and people were leaving, that someone was standing with them and reminding them of hope. It meant the world to them. More recently, in the last couple of years, you may have heard there was outbreak of violence and kidnappings of Haitians. And the stress on our staff, I know, was incredible. Our executive director, Dr. Harry Giffrard, had to take a different route to work every day. And when I heard this, I was quite amazed and quite concerned for him. But to hear that he was still going to work every day was something. And, you know, I can just imagine in Vancouver, we all have commutes to deal with, long drives coming into work. I can't imagine the added stress of fear of possibly being kidnapped on my way into work. Yet the staff kept going, and the doors stayed open and during that time. And because of that, the services continued to Grace Children's Hospital and to about 170,000 people in the north of Haiti and about 25,000 people around Grace Children's Hospital. The United Nations has since then been able to kind of clamp down on the violence by some of the gangs that were doing the kidnappings, and it is once again more safe to travel and visit Haiti, and easier for staff to do their work. Again, it's an example of something that I appreciate and have learned about ICC, the witness of standing with people through the ups and downs, and there have been many downs in Haiti in the last 40 years. Now, I mentioned a second factor determining our actions, and it's our conviction about the value God places on all people. And this, I had a personal lesson to learn in Haiti that has profoundly shaped my life and for which I'll forever be grateful for Haiti, my experience in Haiti. Each day I drive to my office at Grace Children's Hospital, and it's a cement two-block medium-sized hospital in a kind of a suburb of Port-au-Prince, to the extent that Port-au-Prince has suburbs. Port-au-Prince is kind of a city in a bowl around the mountains, and the downtown hot core is right on the ocean, and you have this decaying kind of French colonial architecture with swaying palm trees. You kind of have a sense of the beauty of what it once was. It's very much decaying now, and the city sprawls up the mountains behind it, and Grace Children's Hospital is about halfway up the mountain. And then if you go further up, you get into where some of the more wealthier Haitians live, Pétionville. And every day, I would drive to my office at Grace Children's Hospital. It's home to an inpatient ward of about 70 beds for children with tuberculosis and a few other respiratory problems, diseases that they try to help with, and an outpatient ward that sees about 300 people a day. If you come early in the morning, you'll see the outpatients in the courtyard participating in the morning chapel led by one of the Haitian nursing staff. People wait patiently, some for assessments, seeing the doctor, getting x-rays. Others are coming back to get medicines. And it's a challenge to keep people on treatment. TB patients have to take pills for up to a year. And one of the innovative programs Canadians themselves have actually provided over the years is to provide small Canadian food aid, foodstuffs, as an incentive to bring people back each month to make sure they're checked, get their regimen of medicines, and encouraged to stay on their treatment. Because if you fall off your treatment, that's what leads to the drug resistant strains of TB, which is more and more an issue. Upstairs, you'll find the inpatient ward, which was my favorite place. If you walk up the stairs on the left, is a small intensive care unit where the most sick come. There's malnourished children there with advanced tuberculosis and many with HIV/AIDS. because those two diseases work very closely together. On the right are beds for recovering children and cared for by Haitian doctors, nurses, and bustling matrons, Haitian women who confidently keep the 30 or 40 children bathed, fed, and in check, which is a challenge. The children are joyful, happy, and love to play, tease, and be teased. And then there's a little school room as well to provide teaching for the kids while they spend up to 3 months in our care. One of the things I wanted to mention too is ICC is staffed completely on the field now nationally. It's 200 to 300 Haitian staff in Haiti, and I'm not quite sure what it is in the Dominican Republic, but it's dozens of staff in the Dominican Republic as well. When I lived there, I was one of two or three North American staff there, but there's a real desire to invest and empower Haitian national local leadership. So each day in the course of my work, I encountered many people in desperate need. I would be approached many times a day with personal pleas for help, and I was overwhelmed. There's no way I had the resources to help everyone. Most of the people who came to me were genuine needs. Some didn't. Some were simply trying to get money from me. And a natural coping method I had, I was tempted to have, was to become annoyed by all these people that were constantly bugging me. But I struggled to figure out how to respond in a better way. And a little girl at Grace Children Hospital helped me see the answer. Marie was a little girl who captured my heart, a beautiful, slender 9-year-old. She arrived at Grace malnourished, lethargic, morose, as most children in advanced state of TB do. TB is a disease that invades your lungs and sometimes other parts of your body. And as the immune system erodes from malnourishment, TB becomes active and you begin to hear the telltale sign of coughing as bacteria destroys your lungs. Many of the folks from my parents' generation remember that TB was a big issue. Growing up, my parents did in the prairies and the farm communities and had members of their families that would succumb to it as well. When Marie came, I sat beside her bed and caressed her, trying to get her to laugh. It broke my heart that she couldn't. And now as a parent myself, I would find it even harder. She was immediately put on a TB regimen, and she began to receive 3 nutritious meals a day, plus snacks. As for most kids, the change over the next day, a few days, was miraculous. She began to smile, to respond to the children around her. She was soon up, walking around, and playing. Her beautiful, fun-loving spirit soon had all the children following her. Every day she would give me a big, beautiful hug. And Marie stayed in the ward for 3 months until she was discharged to continue treatment on an outpatient basis. And it was sometime during that time I had a realization. Well, I didn't have the resources to help everyone that approached me each day. I did have something I could give. I could stop and pay attention. That is a simple gift of listening, taking the time to listen and trying to hear their story. Recognizing their human dignity. Trying to see them as Jesus might have seen them. And again, it's one thing to say you understand the value God places in all people, but it's another thing to kind of make it real in the day-to-day situations that you encounter and to actually internalize that. I realized I had a lot to learn from this little girl and her parents. And that perspective, that kind of epiphany to a certain extent, has changed it can't help but profoundly change your perspective of Haiti and about people in general. And I've taken that lesson with me since then for everyone I encounter. Whether it's here in Vancouver now, it's a homeless, or colleagues who are a bit of a pain sometimes. I realize that every person I encounter, I have something to learn from them and their story. And that perspective has enriched my life. I feel much richer for that. It was hard for me to say goodbye to Marie. I know the difficult circumstances children go back to. A few years ago, I received a tremendous gift. I received my ICC newsletter in Vancouver, and there was a story about a lovely young woman who had returned to Grace to thank the hospital staff. She had precious memories of her time receiving treatment, and she was the very same Marie that I had known when I worked there as a 9-year-old. And the odds of that happening, the fact that she had come back to the hospital, she had survived and come back to the hospital, and that someone had picked up on her story and written about it. And it was just a real gift for me to see that in a newsletter now that I was back in Canada. And I wish I could have reached out and told her how much she had enriched my life with her beautiful spirit. Last year, the inpatient clinic treated about 282 children with tuberculosis and a few other diseases and illnesses. The outpatient clinic treated 313 people per day. There's an eye clinic that sees 45 patients each day, and some other small growing programs. An HIV/AIDS clinic provided counseling to more than 2,000 adults and microfinancing to some of these women with AIDS to help them start businesses. So again, during difficult times, there has been work that has gone on. Finally, I wanted to share one aspect of ICC that's come to have special meaning to me. In the 1980s, ICC launched an outreach into the Dominican Republic, as I've mentioned. It's quite a different country, has a Spanish background. It was one of the first places, I think it's, they claim it's the first place Christopher Columbus discovered. ICC saw an opportunity to move in and work because there's a lot of Haitian maybe economic refugees who go to the Dominican Republic to try to find work and actually work in quite dismal, difficult situations. Quite often they are the ones that the Dominicans get to do the manual work of cutting sugarcane. And since then, ICC has grown various health community health programs with the church and with the government partnerships. And it has a very innovative program to support children with disabilities, traditionally a cause for shame in the Dominican Republic. Many children with disabilities, like cerebral palsy, were kept in back rooms, typically, and left kind of to shrivel away. The parents felt a sense of shame. You can imagine the lack of care or medical support in poor communities and slums. About 15 years ago, ICC went in to conduct some surveys, again, going house to house to find these children and begin to meet with parents. So to discover where these children were, as I said, they weren't out about in the community. They were kind of left in the back rooms of small homes. And they identified volunteers from the communities, parents themselves, trained them on conducting home visits, providing basic physical therapy and emotional support. And they organized, helped the parents get organized themselves and to the extent that they were organizing their own local fundraisers to support their work. So it was amazing to see the transformation of these parents from shame to pride and hope for their children, that they began to see them through God's eyes and to see their potential. And last year, ICC was able to provide about rehabilitation services to about 400 children with disabilities, with 32 Dominican workers, that is, parents trained in their own communities, visiting these children regularly. Again, it speaks to the powerful combination of God's love and promises of hope and community empowerment and the transformation that can come from that. And I've just been really incredibly inspired by the spirit of the mothers and fathers of those children who have disabilities, who have faced the stigmas and live in with very few resources, yet have taken action and gotten themselves organized. And all it took was a little encouraging hand. So as I come to the end of my talk, I hope I've given you a sense of the elements of international child care, its programs that deliver health care in an empowering way, and the values behind our ICC efforts. The Christian faith, love, dignity, and respect. And I hope, too, that if you're one of those who've asked the question about what difference does it make, my thoughts and experience might have something to offer you. Somehow for me, it seems the answer lies in fostering a sense of God's promises of hope, my belief in that, and cultivating an appreciation of the value of others that I meet every day, regardless of their stories, or respect for their stories, and a learning from their stories. I found that in responding, something special has happened. You see something help, a work of grace in those we seek to help, but probably more important, a work of great grace in my own heart. So thanks very much again for taking the time and to listen to me this morning.